The latest episode from Washington of
How Not to Do Financial Planning.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, March 12th.
Coming up, how spending $250 million on a movie is no ticket to success.
And rattling around the Fed's bag of tricks.
Plus, hi, my name is Jeremy, and I am an internet hotspot.
Those stories are more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today, the Bank of Japan is holding a meeting to talk about monetary policy for the third largest economy in the world. And for the first time in a while, officials in Japan can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Factory activity picking up and domestic demand increasing as the country marks 1 year since the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster. Marketplace's Scott Tong recently visited the country to see how people he met a year ago are holding up.
Last year, I ran into some first-grade girls at an evacuation shelter. They skipped rope. They sang the school song from the hometown they fled. One mom, Emika Shiga, wondered at the time about her job at an auto part factory near Fukushima. Would it start up again? Would they keep her on the payroll? Fast forward 1 year, and she's fired.
The factory resumed production just outside the nuclear zone, but I'm here with my family and my husband's job. It's too far away. So as of March 10th, I'm fired.
The boss gave workers exactly 1 year to return or else. So Emika Shiga's thinking of another line of work, perhaps part-time. For now, though, family is job one. They've moved 4 times since the tsunami. Her son and her daughter have a new school with a new song. She is a busy mom. She drives the kids to school and hustles grandparents around town. They evacuated too. And she waits through official papers to get reimbursement from the nuclear power plant, whose meltdown kicked them out of their homes. Probably forever, says her husband.
The whole town has to be decontaminated to a low level of radiation before anyone moves back. I doubt that will happen. It's sad, but we can't look back.
If anything good has come out of this, Japan has shown it takes care of its own. The Shiga family has received 10 months of unemployment pay, 2 years' worth of rent stipends, and an army of volunteer helpers.
All these people sharing their generosity, it's far more than I had imagined.
And she didn't imagine the family dog would be here. When the family fled, they left it behind. But a month later, they made a quick trip back home. Somehow, without any food, the hound survived. In Saitama, Japan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So optimism for one Japanese family. Now let's get the view of the entire Japanese economy. Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how is the Japanese economy doing 1 year after the disaster?
Well, as your story noted, a lot of it is up and running again, so most production is back to normal. There is still a tremendous amount of rebuilding, however, that has to be done, and that's only getting off the ground very gradually.
Now, we mentioned, Julia, that it's the third largest economy in the world, so as it does rebound gradually, as you say, what does that mean for us?
Well, it is important. We found that out last year. When the earthquake hit and the supply chain disruptions happened, it really had a material impact on the U.S. economy as well. So it should be helpful to us that won't be a drag this year, that it will be, in fact, enjoying some stimulus from the rebuilding efforts. So that's constructive for the global economy.
What about the supply chain issues that came up last year about all the things that are made in Japan? Has that sort of filtered through at this point?
Well, it's largely filtered through. One of the unfortunate side effects for Japan is that they've lost some competitiveness from this. Some of the supply chain resolution was that some of these contracts simply got shifted overseas. That's been a helpful thing to the U.S. and Germany, but it also means that Japan's lost some long-term competitiveness.
Well, finally, Julia, what's the biggest challenge for the country going forward?
Well, Japan still faces a huge problem from the aging of their population. They've just got a tremendous overweight of elderly people on benefits relative to the productive population. And in fact, their population is shrinking. So they're not going to be a powerhouse growth economy anytime soon.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always.
It's a pleasure.
Now let's do a household budget. Mortgage, check. Utilities, check. How about the bill for genetic testing? A study by the United Health Group, it was released this morning, says we spent about $5 billion on genetic tests in 2010 and could spend, get this, $25 billion by the end of the decade. Joining me to talk from our health desk is Gregory Warner. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gregory, genetic testing, what, like tests that pregnant moms take to check for maybe Down syndrome?
Exactly. And then after they give birth, there's more tests. You can scan to see if a newborn is susceptible to cystic fibrosis. Steve Jobs used genetic tests to pick the right drugs for his tumors. Right now, there are over 1,000 different tests, with 3 to 5 new tests coming out each month. And sometimes a single test can cost you $3,000 to $4,000.
Doing the math there, 1,000 different tests, thousands of dollars per test. So even then, though, $25 billion seems like a large number. How did we get there?
Right. It doesn't quite add up, right? So I put that question to Harry Oster. He's director of genetic and genomic testing at Montefiore Medical Center and a professor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. His answer took less time than it took me to say his work title.
Whole genome sequencing.
Whole genome sequencing. This is where you can sequence every gene in your DNA in one test. And the cost of that just slipped under $1,000. That puts us into the territory where it's starting to be cheaper to have all your genes sequenced than any one specific disease. And that means doctors are going to be a lot more willing to scan your genes. Insurers are going to be a lot more willing to pay for it. In fact, Harry Oster is in dialogue now with the New York Board of Health about changing their policy for newborns. Instead of giving them a battery of 45 different tests, just scan all their genes, get a lot more information, may cost less. Of course, when costs go down, demand goes up. That's going to happen, he says, in the genetic market.
All right, just scan them all. Marketplace's Gregory Warner, thank you very much.
Thanks.
The Senate this week is trying to overhaul one of the bulkiest lines in the federal budget, America's transportation program. Funding for more than 100,000 highway and transit projects ends this month unless lawmakers pass an extension. And usually those extensions go for five or 6 years. But this time around, partisan bickering means long-term projects may only get a 2-year patch. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on why this matters.
Big fixes for traffic congestion can take 3 or more years. John Horsley at the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials says contractors want to know they're going to be paid.
What you're seeing for the moment is projects selected that you can execute in one construction season. The longer-term big projects right now are on hold.
And that means only Band-Aids for crumbling highways, says Gregory Cohen. He's president of the American Highway Users Alliance, representing truck, bus, and other highway users.
When you do a long-term bill, not only do you create those construction jobs, but you also get the projects done that really improve the economy on a grand scale.
But so far, Congress has been unable to come up with any transportation funding beyond 2 years, which means even tougher revenue-raising decisions somewhere down the road. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Call it a pop-up skyscraper. A 30-story hotel project was erected in China in just 2 weeks. How do you do this? And another clear and present question is, could this really be safe? Here to talk with us is John Qualley of the University of Virginia School of Architecture. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Well, how is it possible to do something like this so quickly, Professor?
It takes a lot of advanced planning off-site. So the project that you're referencing is one that probably had a fair amount of work completed in a factory, coming up with a series of components, prefabricating a series of components that were then very strategically delivered to the site in such a way that it could be assembled as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because, I mean, even concrete's going to take longer than 2 weeks to set, right?
That's exactly right. So any concrete that was used would have been precast offsite. And for the most part, the building is steel frame. And obviously, if you do that right and you've got all the dimensions correct and everything sitting on trucks ready to be craned into place, it can go relatively quickly.
So when are we going to see skyscrapers going up in 2 weeks here in this country?
Well, I'm not sure that we'll see them in 2 weeks, per se. We have a slightly different building industry in the U.S. The building industry in China is just transforming itself very, very, very quickly. In the U.S., we have a slightly different method of attempting to do this kind of stuff. In particular, what you're going to be seeing more of in the next decade is more modular commercial construction, meaning volumetric pieces of buildings, chunks of buildings, in a sense, being placed into a steel frame, and they can go up very, very quickly. There's one that is going to happen in Brooklyn later this year. It's called the Atlantic Yards Project. And that project will be modular offsite and assembled relatively quickly.
So you sound pretty relaxed about this. You think if ever you're over in China, you'd go into a building that was erected in 2 weeks?
I have to say my first response when I saw that video is it felt like there may be some concerns about the personal safety of the workers on the project. And I also felt that it would be pretty difficult in that short a time to do all the proper fire protection and other aspects of construction that may not be the kind of exciting things that show up in YouTube videos but are essential for the public safety of those that occupy the building. I'm a little on the fence on this one because it's conceivable that it's being promoted as something that went up in 2 weeks, and in reality, they spent another month or so going through and making sure they're buttoning it up appropriately. Or perhaps they're not, and there may be a larger concern.
Well, Professor, I mean, you make some good points about why we don't see these things go up so quickly, for instance, over here. But it does seem like there's a big difference between 2 weeks in China, I guess. And, you know, if you go down to the World Trade Center, David, you're not far from there. That building, we're 10 years after 9/11, and that thing's not done.
Well, there's also a political situation there that's at play. That's
right, but it takes a lot longer to build a building, I guess.
It does. It absolutely does. The other thing that's starting to emerge in Europe and in the U.S. is a recognition that modular offsite construction can reduce environmental impact. If you are able to speed up the process, you can find that it actually measurably can reduce the broader environmental impact of construction. So there are advantages to this, but I would be cautious about imagining that we're going to see skyscrapers going up in 2 weeks in the U.S. anytime soon.
All right. So what we'll do is we'll send Jeremy into the new Chinese skyscraper that was built in 2 weeks. If it checks out for him, Professor Qualley, you can go in second.
Okay.
All right. John Qualley, UVA Architecture. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
No problem.
And Jeremy, did you see this?
What?
Is it cool, or does this have kind of the creepy Blade Runner or Minority Report feel? At South by Southwest, that yearly festival of interactive media in Austin, they're turning homeless people into internet connections.
Whoa.
People from a local homeless shelter can sign up to wear a wireless device that turns them into a Wi-Fi hotspot in return for a donation via PayPal. It's an update on homeless people getting entrepreneurial by selling newspapers. This is according to BBH Labs, the outfit behind the effort. The Twitter has been critical. I've been reading it this morning. Dehumanizing offensive, ran one representative tweet.
Yeah.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now the Marketplace Global Perspective. Europe's biggest airlines say a new European tax on the carbon dioxide coming out of their jet engines is a bad idea. Executives at British Airways, Air France, Lufthansa, and the aircraft maker Airbus have signed a letter calling for a delay for the new carbon tax. The levy has already drawn the ire of China, which could delay buying new European-made jetliners in retaliation.
Ian Clark works at a British legal firm that specializes in aviation law and joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Help me understand the objection here to this carbon tax.
Well, this is a tax which is being applied to airlines from all over the world if they fly to, from, or within the European Union. The problem is that it is effectively taxing airlines for their operations outside the EU, as well as when they are actually here.
So it's not an objection to the idea of putting a price on this kind of pollution known as carbon dioxide.
I think the airlines feel it's fairly unfair because airlines strive to improve their fleets all the time. And the efficiency of jet engines over the last 10 or 20 years has been really quite enormous. And there's little that the individual airline can do about it. The whole idea of emissions trading was to have various industries reduce their carbon footprint and their emissions. And, of course, a factory can actually take some steps about that. But at the moment, airlines are really bound to buy either from one or other of the major aircraft manufacturers who are already doing their level best to reduce the emissions from engines.
Any calculations on the cost if this tax were to go forward for the airlines?
Oh, it's measured in billions of dollars.
In the billions. All right. Ian Clark works at a British law firm that specializes in aviation law. Mr. Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tonight is the night for NBC, David. Back when dinosaurs ruled the Earth, of course, NBC promoted must-see TV on Thursday. I think I remember that. So there must have been dinosaurs during human years.
Yeah,
tonight,
you bet.
Tonight, they will try must-see Monday as the television network tries the strategy of starting the week with its biggest primetime hopes, in this case, The Voice and Smash. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains the significance.
Thursday night, you used to be the night for NBC. Remember Seinfeld, Friends, The Cosby Show?
The era of NBC dominating Thursday nights is over.
Tim Molloy is television editor for TheWrap.com. He says NBC's current Thursday night shows, like 30 Rock, are just no match for the Death Star, black hole, ratings eater that is American Idol on Fox. So NBC is putting a lot of effort into its Monday nights.
It's a pretty good night for television because absolutely no one goes out.
Everyone's home, ready to watch The Voice on NBC, which Molloy says now has better ratings than any primetime show, including American Idol. Robert Thompson teaches TV and popular culture at Syracuse University. He says it's the show that matters, not the night it's on. Even on Friday and Saturday nights, potential suicide slots when people are out and about.
In the end, you put a really good program that people want to watch on a Friday night, and they'll stay home and watch it.
And advertisers will follow. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Who says the Federal Reserve is out of tricks? Ahead of a meeting of our central bankers tomorrow, we shrug off the lethargy of daylight savings time Monday by catching up with Alan Sloan, Fortune Magazine senior editor-at-large. Hello, Mr. Sloan.
Good morning, David.
So, our central bank, the Federal Reserve, had this thing last fall, Operation Twist, something about lowering longer-term interest rates. But then all these people are talking about the Fed is running out of tools to help stimulate the economy. Have they completely run out?
Well, every time you think they have, they create something else. And the latest trial balloon is something with a wonderful name called sterilized bond purchases.
Sterilizing the bond purchases. What is that?
Well, one way is maybe they don't want the bonds to reproduce, but the real meaning of this is that the Fed would buy long-term bonds, which puts money into the world, and then it would take money out of the world by creating short-term securities other people would buy. So at the end of the day, you have the Fed forcing down long-term rates without adding to the money supply.
So, I mean, it's really, again, the Fed finding a new way to go shopping for bonds.
Right. This way they get what they want, which is to lower long-term interest rates without upsetting markets and various worriers about inflation by taking the money that's created by buying the bonds and taking it back out of the financial markets.
Now, Mr. Sloan, I got to ask you, is this a good or bad idea?
Oh, I don't know if it's going to work. But what I do know is whatever you think of the Fed, unlike the rest of the American government, it's actually trying to do something. It's trying to force down interest rates. It's trying to stimulate the economy. And unlike the Republicans and the Democrats, it's not doing stuff that will never pass in order to make political points. You got to give them points for honesty and trying.
Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large, Fortune Magazine, thank you very much.
You're welcome, David.
And finally, to something that is on the verge of extinction in these modern times, David. It's not a sea turtle or some obscure plant or a bird. It is the church bowling alley.
Extinct, you say?
Yes, apparently. They are a dying breed. According to USA Today, thanks to the growing popularity of lunchrooms and meeting areas, there are now fewer than 200 church bowling alleys left in America. Which got me thinking, there were 200 church bowling alleys in America?
Which got me thinking, the renewed popularity of the idea of a lunchroom? That's always nice.
They're big in 2012, I guess.
All right, in New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.